Welcome to the Missio Dei podcast. Missio Dei is a family of Jesus, joining God as he makes all things new in Chicago. Check us out online at missiodeichicago.com.
I think it's been 15 years since Missio Dei has supported the work that I'm a part of. And for that, you can think about millions of children having been touched by God's love who live in awful places where there's active conflict, where there's war. And for that, I'm deeply grateful for your generosity and faithfulness to me and to the work that I'm a part of. Thank you. So this verse that we read this morning is kind of interesting. Blessed are you who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for you shall be filled. I've always kind of felt confused about that verse and one that follows a bit later. It says, blessed are you who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. Have you ever wondered about these verses? For yours is the kingdom of God. Righteousness, this word righteousness is a weird word to me. Because as I understand it, righteousness has to do with individual holiness or self-righteousness in our culture. That's the way it's most often understood. Maybe we think of it as righting a wrong, but mostly not. In our culture, it has to do with an individual sense of moral rectitude or holiness. And so I dug around a little to understand this word because the Beatitudes are kind of important. Like, this is the most important sermon Jesus ever preached. And this is a list of beautiful statements that's not just poetry, but like it's a list, it's a manifesto of how to live. And so I dug into this word and I had some help. Have you guys heard of Tim Keller? Maybe. Well, I read this book of his that blew my mind called A Generous Justice. Have any of you read that book? I mean, when I was doing my master's degree, doing a study on this word, and I read it and I thought, Tim Keller's going to get himself kicked out of evangelicalism for this book because it's so radical and it's so off the beaten path of a lot of our movement. And you'll understand this in a second. And so I read it and I was blown away. This word righteousness, back in 1611, when King James convened his council to decide for all times what scripture is for all of us, righteousness meant what it means there. It meant overarching righteousness, a state of righteousness had to do with things working and in harmony socially under God's law. It literally meant that, but it meant two other things. It meant an inner state of harmony where our values are in alignment and we are in a living embodiment of those values. That's a righteous person. But it meant something else too. It meant three things. The third thing kind of fits with the first. And that is that righteousness is profoundly social. It is visible. When a wrong is righted or corrected, there's no question about what's been done. There's no confusion about that event. Righteousness has happened. A wrong has been righted by a person or a people, and you see it. It's self-evident. It's visible. That's what that word meant. And that's why in English, the word righteousness was chosen. So every English Bible until today uses this word. Problem is, over time, word meanings change, right? Righteousness has become an individual word, a word especially appropriated by the holiness movement, personal holiness. So that's why I was confused, because I got my start in this faith thing at a Pentecostal church, and righteousness had to do with holiness. It was kind of like a synonym. So it was confusing to me. Why, if I'm holy, are people going to persecute me? And then I'm going to be favored by God. Why does he even say that? It was confusing. And why are we supposed to hunger and thirst for holiness? I mean, okay, I get it. Right? I mean, read James, read the Corinthian letters. We are to hunger and thirst for holiness. But still, as this rule for life, it confused me. So I dug around And here's what I found. That word, righteousness, is diakosune. I'm not a Bible scholar, none of that. I just read those guys. Diakosune means justice that is profoundly social. It was used 400 years before Christ by Plato, who wrote The Just Republic. The Just Republic uses that exact same word. Everyone in Greek culture understood when he said that word, what that word meant. And that word meant those three things. Right? English used righteousness. French used justice from the very beginning, back in the 1600s. They used justice. I speak Norwegian. It's justice. I also speak Thai, Kwam Chop Tam. That means justice. Every language that I've looked at, in fact, I know this for a fact, English is the only language that uses a word that indicates personal holiness, a word called righteousness. The rest of the world reads the Bible and they see justice. This word is used 80 times in the New Testament. Paul uses it something like 60 times, mostly in Romans, but Matthew also loves this word. Justice has to do with righting a wrong. It's seeing something wrong in our world and saying, I own that, I'm going to do something about it. And then correcting it is an act of justice that is profoundly social. It's visible. This beautiful word used over and over again is a way of describing the life of faith. If you read Romans, when you read righteousness, substitute the word for justice every single time, and it will read like a different book. Same in Matthew. So when you read the Beatitude, when I realized this and read the Beatitudes again, I was blown away, because what it says is we should hunger and thirst for justice. The world is off kilter, and we should care about hungering and thirsting. Why did he even use those words? Because it's a visceral appetite. We have to have food and water. If we don't, at some point, we'll kill for it. We absolutely have to have water and food. This is the muscular way that Jesus brings this appetite down to us. As Christians, we hunger and thirst for righting the wrongs that we see in our world. This is why we're here. Now, if you question that, I'd like to step back a little farther before I get into the story I want to tell you. Like, depending on who, well, I'll just say, back farther to Deuteronomy. The Old Testament uses two words for justice. Mishpat and tzedakah. Mishpat are the actions of justice. These are the things we do to right wrongs. Tzedakah is a state of justice that's once achieved, God's favor is upon us collectively, and the mishpat actions, the actions of justice, have succeeded. These two words are important because they're used over 400 times in the Old Testament. Every judiciary, I mean, Leviticus is filled with it, but even, okay, we read the creed, right? I mean, just think about this word mishpat being central to our creed. The gleanings for the poor in Deuteronomy that Moses said you had to leave for the widow, the alien, or the migrant, the orphan, and the poor, that's mishpat. The Levitical laws that require us, or the Hebrew tribe, to care for the same quintet, mishpat. And the prophet's message over and over again is get this right or your crops will fail, plagues will come, you'll go into captivity, you will suffer, and basically I don't like you anymore. That's what God says over and over again through the prophets. And what happens after the prophet prophesies? Boom, back in captivity, because they didn't listen. Amos says, righteousness and justice are the foundation of my throne. Or wait, let righteousness and justice flow like a mighty river. That's what he says after his long, you know, six chapters of prophecy. And what he's saying is, your rituals are gross and disgusting. Stop singing praise songs to me and start doing this instead, because this is my character. This is what I'm about. And if you would only do that, good things are coming. That's what the message of Amos, Jeremiah, Isaiah, Hezekiah, all of them, every single prophet's the same broken record message. And I would think we would get the message, I don't know how we don't. Okay. It's not just our actions. It's not just what we do or what we're called to be or do in society. It's also the very character of God. 30 times in the Psalms, we understand that God's throne, in English it says, his throne is established on righteousness and justice. That's the foundation of God's throne. The very central character of God is righteousness and justice in English. That's Mishpat and Tzedakah. 30 times in Psalms alone. We cannot even conceive of God without understanding justice. Are y'all with me? This stuff blew my mind, and I felt betrayed by all my mentors. You know, like even Stott, Sproul, Ryle, Packer, all the guys that we've all read. Well, if you're like me, I read those guys. Okay? Well, then you read their academic papers, and they bump into justice, and they say, hey, this one's a little complicated. They never write that in their popular books. It's only in their academic papers. And I felt incredibly betrayed by these mentors. Okay, so I kept digging. I found Tim Keller. I'd like to tell you about Rose. Rose was born into a wealthy family in colonial Burma. She lived in Rangoon. She had all the privilege that wealth affords in this Asian country. This is after the colonial authorities left. This is after World War II. And Rose is born into this luxury life. It's a dictatorship. It's the longest running civil war in the world. It's like over 60 years of war. But if you're wealthy, you can kind of live above the bombs. But over time, as Anglicans, as faithful churchgoers, Rose, who became a teacher, and her husband, who was a doctor, decided that their skills were needed in the frontiers or the border of their country, because the border is where people are fleeing as the regime kills the people who are born above the resources that the regime wants. I'm oversimplifying everything here, but that's basically the story. Are you guys with me? So Rose and her husband say goodbye to luxury. They make a long, week-long trek. They cross the Moy River into Thailand and go to Shoglo refugee camp, where there are 9,000 refugees. And her husband sets up a clinic, the first one in that camp, and Rose sets up a school for young kids who are falling through the cracks of the system. After 2 years, Rose decided she would go home to visit her family. On her way there, she was stopped at a military checkpoint, and at that checkpoint, she was understood now not to be one of the elite families in the country who, you know, live under the favor of the dictators. Now, she is anti-government because she has chosen to leave that life of luxury to help the anti-government movement. Anti-government, right? They're only anti-government because they're in the way of the rubies, the jade, the oil, the natural gas, the molybdenum, and all the other rare earth metals that are needed in the world and used and exploited by the regime in Myanmar to this day. Okay, so she gets caught at this checkpoint. Now she's anti-government, and they put her in prison. In prison, she went through every awful thing that a pretty woman could go through in prison. In that prison. It's a prison for political prisoners. Torture and violence of every type was common there, and it all happened to her. Her family tried to get her out and exhausted their wealth and their contacts to get her out of prison. Her husband's family did the same thing, exhausting both their wealth and their contacts to get Rose out of prison. After 9 months, miraculously, according to the family, according to Rose, Rose was set free. She's very lucky she didn't die in there. She gets set free and overland makes her way back to the Moy River, crosses the river, and goes into her camp to the bamboo hut where she left her husband. And what she found was her husband was dead. He had died 2 weeks before she got out of prison. And he was killed. Some say he was abusing alcohol and he was overdosed with diazepam. The clinic staff were trying to help him because he was losing it. Why? Because his wife is being violated in this horrible prison. He can't get her out. Anyhow, he's dead. What would you do? I don't know what I would do. But I wouldn't do what she did. Of course she grieved. I mean, of course this broke her heart. Having survived that awful 9 months, coming to the camp, now husband's dead, she visited his grave just across the river. They buried him on the other side of the river in Burma. Rose started a book club. And this is not a normal book club. She built a bamboo shack next to her bamboo shack. Every refugee lives in a bamboo shack on the border. And she built this shack, and she called it a book club, but she only invited women who had been violated like she was. Her idea was that God's grace is powerful enough to redeem the story and restore dignity to her and to all of them, everyone who suffered that way. And so Rose invited these women to come to her book club, and they spent part of each week talking, grieving, crying with one another, watching out for one another, helping each other, helping restore to each other a place of belonging, self-respect, and dignity. Then she saw that there was a problem. There wasn't enough food in the camp. She started this little farm. And the farm was, it was a pig and fish. Somehow she knew about integrated farming. I have no idea where she learned it. But she started this little farm and started feeding fish to the families that weren't able to access the aid that was available. Because they're broken down. Step on a landmine, dad's face is blown off. He's lucky to be alive, lost a foot, you know, other stuff. Broken down, ran for their lives, the things that happen to girls, the thing that happens to men, you know, all this stuff happens and they're witness to it. They survive, they're lucky, they're in a refugee camp. This is the end of the road for human experience. Now they don't have a passport, they don't have a citizenship, they're nowhere, no future. That's how they see it. So they break down. So Rose sees the need for food and starts serving these people. Then she saw a growing need to help families who couldn't get their kids into class. There are schools in the camps, but some of the families just didn't have it in them to get their kids up, dressed, and ready for school. And Rose went around like the Pied Piper in this camp of 9,000 and swallowed all these kids into her home. And every age, and she was a teacher, so she taught them, you know, reading, writing, and arithmetic. And it was a joyous, beautiful school right on the Shoklo River in Shoklo Refugee Camp. And that's when I met her. And she told my wife and I this story while we're sitting on the floor drinking tea from a dented tin cup, you know, a recycled can of soup or something. And when she told us this story, we were blown away for a few reasons. One of the reasons, and probably the most significant one to me, and the reason we kept going back is because I saw myself as a kind of theologically astute leader. I started a couple of churches. I was running an evangelism base in Chiang Mai, Thailand. Thought I was like missionary stuff. Well, I met Rose, and she had something I didn't have. And I immediately saw it. And I thought, whatever that is, I don't have it and I want it. So I was intrigued, and my wife was too. And so we visited her like 5 times. It was a 12-hour ride. We didn't have a car back then, so we took the bus in the back of a truck and we had to walk, and it was a throw-up trip. We would get there and then we'd sit down on the bamboo floor and learn from Rose. So on our fifth trip, about, this is like September 1994. We're sitting on the floor of her bamboo hut. And she says, and there's a little girl sleeping on the floor. I said, Rose, who's this child? She said, well, pro-democracy soldiers were sent to that kid's village to find survivors and to document what happened for the human rights record. And when they got to her village, they found one survivor, one living survivor. And that was this 4-year-old girl. What they said is that the likely story, because she was in a good hiding place, is that her family, her loved ones, mom and dad, aunt or uncle, big brother, whoever, was running as the village was being attacked, and knowing or believing that they would get caught, they hid this little girl and said, shh, don't say a word. Wait for us to come back or wait for the good guys. We don't have no idea how long she sat in that hiding place, but she was found by the good guys, the pro-democracy soldiers from the Karen tribe. They picked her up. They carried her to the Moy River, crossed the river into Shoglo refugee camp, and guess who they took her to? Why do you think they took her to Rose? Everybody knew that Rose had that thing. What is that thing? How do we get that thing? The soldiers knew. Word got out that this lady helps everyone. And so they took her to, they took this four-year-old little girl to Rose and told her the story and said, will you be her foster mother? Her parents may pop up. We don't know. She's alone in the world. She may be an orphan. We don't know. There were, at the time, 9 million internally displaced people running around in the jungle trying to hide from the Burma army. Are you still with me? Okay, so Rose said yes. Of course she said yes. And then, like, 2 days later, we showed up, and she told us this story. She looked up into our eyes, and she said, will you help me? I want to help this little girl, and I need a little help for that, if you could. But actually, why don't we do something to help all the kids like this? Because it happens every day. Let's help kids who are unaccompanied because of war, who are living through the violence of war. Let's do something. And you know that feeling when someone talks about a need and you feel like garbage? You feel guilty because, like, I have more money. Why aren't I using it? And I go to Starbucks every day, and why don't I stop doing that and send the money to the poor? You know that guilt feeling? Do you have that inner dialogue? I mean, I do. So, you know, think of Gaza. It makes me feel terrible. Okay, and that's legitimate. I'm not, but this was different. The reason I'm telling this part of the story is because what I saw was that. I saw the thing that I'm lacking. Like, for me, I realized this lady who lived through hell, who's living in hell and making heaven out of it, not just for herself, but in the service of others, is this vibrant, alive embodiment of everything I think Jesus is about. That's what she is. And that's why, having nothing, she takes in this little girl. And then we happen to show up, and she asks us to help. This wasn't a guilt trip. It was like an invitation to something amazing. Like, Rose said, Steve, we can change the world. Let's do it. And for me, it was like, hell yeah, let's go. Let's change the world. It's the first time I thought, okay, let's do something really beautiful and not just talk about love, but let's be love. That's what she had. I made a career out of talking about love. Rose did it. And that's the secret. That's what she had that I didn't have. That, my friends, the story is a lot longer. This lady took in a Burma army defector. I've never met any refugee who did that. She not only nursed him back from death because the people in the camp beat him up nearly to death, left him on the ground. Someone walked by this guy, and the guy begged for mercy. He said, "Would please help me?" And the guy said, "Nobody here is going to help you." And then he said, "But there's one lady that helps everyone." He said, "If you can crawl a half a mile up the hill, there's a lady named Rose." Do you hear this? Like, so this guy crawls to her doorway, parts the cloth door where 84 orphans and unaccompanied children are living with Rose. Her family expanded. This is 15 years later. And the embodiment of everything that's wrong with their world walks in. And what does Rose do? She forgives him. She nurses him. She gives him food and water. She makes him the night watchman for her home because there's 84 little kids, and, you know, there's bad people in every population. So let's watch out for these kids. This guy ends up giving his life to Christ, and he calls his wife, who's living in Myanmar. He was actually kidnapped from a street corner, didn't want to be a soldier in the first place, starved, beaten, put on methamphetamines, given a rifle to kill. He laid down his rifle, crossed the border, the Moy River, came to this camp. Who does he end up with? The lady who's Jesus, like this now slightly overweight Karen woman in her late 50s, who is Jesus Christ embodied. You know, like, I've never seen that kind of love before. I got a call 3 weeks later, at my house. Rose is in a coma. Come quickly. I drove down. The hospital treated her, but she had an aneurysm, they think, and they couldn't take care of her, so they sent her home because she can't die in the hospital. She's illegal. And so they sent her to the refugee camp to die. She's laying on her bamboo floor, and I walked in the door. Here's 84 kids on the left, all lined up, you know, tending to Rose. And the Burma Army defector is on the floor tenderly brushing her cheek with a cold compress and making sure she's comfortable and caring for her. I mean, you guys, does this ever happen? The enemy and the victim become this close, leading each other from life to death, back and forth? For me, it was like, oh my gosh, this is the gospel. This is what Jesus is all about, right there on the floor. And so here's the point. Rose was Matthew 5. The whole thing, and especially chapter 6, she was blessed because she hungered and thirsted for righteousness. She was there to be the embodiment of justice and correct a wrong. And what happens when we right a wrong? It does something inside of us that gets us over our pain. Henri Nguyen wrote a lot about this. Wounded healers. That's us. We're wounded healers. Of course, we're all traumatized. We're all broken. Life's tough. Everything. All that. For sure true. So what do we do about it? What I learned from Rose and what I have learned from life is that what we do about it is look out for someone else. We find our healing as we express love, because there's some exchange that happens where we are filled with love and it heals and changes us. We become aware of things we weren't aware of before. There's a magical, beautiful, miraculous healing in the service of others. And so, Rose was Mishpat, who cultivated a state of tzedakah in her home and in her community. Let's do that. That's my point. Let's do that. Can we do that? Right here in Chicago, there's a single mom sitting next to you that needs groceries and babysitting next week because she doesn't have a life. Her three kids are everything for her, but she's falling. She needs help. Prop her up. You know, the immigrant story that you're very involved in, that's a story of Mishpat. We can arrive at tzedakah, but it depends on us. We stand up for what we believe in, and we right or wrong. It may be as simple as doing it in our own families. Whatever it is, do that. Be Rose. You have supported the work that I do. Right now, I work in Ukraine with my team in Iraq and in Myanmar, all places where there's active conflict and where children live in that conflict. The work that Novi does is work to restore childhoods for kids who are victims of war. Thank you for being a part of that. I hope all of you would sign up right there for our mailing list and be a part of our conversation about how we help these people. I hope all of you will take the literature that's there. But I'm not it. What's it is that. What's it is what Rose had. I hope I am learning to have it. And together today, we celebrate the embodiment of that who is Jesus. And so, Missio Dei, keep being like Rose. God bless you.
Thanks for tuning in. We'd love to keep the conversation going. Find a weekly gathering or gospel community in a neighborhood near you. To find out more, check us out online at missiodeichicago.com.